netcasting from Chicago, Los Angeles, and Sydney. You're listening to this week's FX Podcast from FXGuide.com.
Thanks for joining us for this FX Podcast, and happy holidays from all of the FX Guide team. I'm Jeff Huser. Today, we're going to hear an interview that Mike Seymour did while he and John Montgomery attended SIGGRAPH Asia. We try to cover all the major trade shows, NAB, SIGGRAPH, IBC, and we do the trade shows because we get FaceTime with people and access, like our guest today, Brian Green from Pixar. Mike was able to sit with him after he gave his talk. Before we get to that, I wanted to take advantage of the holiday season to make sure we thanked a bunch of people who work very hard to make FX Guide possible throughout the year. I mentioned the FX Guide team, and usually hear from myself, John, or Mike in these podcasts, on FX Guide TV, and in classes over at our online training site, FX PhD. But the team includes many people I want to take a minute to mention right here. I'm based in Los Angeles, and in Sydney, in addition to Mike Seymour, you'll find Matt Graham, who, if you listen to our VFX Show podcast, you might recognize. He's often a contributor there. Jimmy Shen. If you're in FX PhD, you'll see Jimmy pop up from time to time doing shoots, various shoots that we do as part of our training there. And joining us full-time now is Ian Fales, whose byline you're going to see a lot on stories coming up. You already have over the years. We've worked with Ian off and on over the years, but Ian's going to be focusing on visual effects for FX Guide full-time now, so that's very exciting news. And also in Australia, we need to mention Debbie Fernall and Dave Edgar on the FX PhD team. John Montgomery's in our Chicago office, and he works with Mark, David, Miles, and Keith. Mark Descoli and David do a lot of behind-the-scenes heavy lifting for FX PhD, as well as FX Guide. And Miles and Keith are helping us redo a lot of the underpinnings of FX Guide. Can't really say much more about that, but keep your eyes open very soon for some exciting changes to the site to bring it to a more modern state. We kind of, every now and then, we just kind of have to go back and revisit everything having to do with the site because, you know, as things grow and evolve, you end up doing a lot of patchwork and adding things on, and sometimes it's good to just kind of go back and say, okay, how do we reset the clock? So you're going to see that's going to give us a lot of capabilities that we haven't had before and should be a much better experience than it has been. Even though it's been quite nice. Anyway, we're proud of what we've done here, what we've built, all starting back in 1999 when John and Mike and I met on Flame News and decided to team up to share tips and information. I'm proud to call them my closest friends, and we look very much forward to doing even more stuff for the visual effects community in the coming year. It's going to be exciting times. Okay, enough holiday cheer. Let's jump into this podcast. So Mike got to sit down with Brian Green. Brian's a character supervisor at Pixar, who has the unique distinction of being the character supervisor on the most successful movie of all time twice, because Finding Nemo broke all box office records in 2003, and Toy Story 3 broke those same records in 2010. He was also a character supervisor on the feature Ratatouille. He joined Pixar in 1997 after watching Toy Story and loving the film. His first assignment was A Bug's Life, doing modeling, rigging, shading, and lighting, and later he worked on Monsters, Inc. as a character lead. Before Pixar, he worked at Animalogic, where he did advertising, effects, animation, and he has several patents related to his work. So let's cross over now to Mike, sitting down with Brian Green.
So Brian, thanks so much for joining us. Really appreciate it. We wanted to talk about some of the practicalities of putting out a feature film like A Toy Story. And the film's great, but there are obviously places where modern theory about how you might approach a shot hits the steel wall of just the practicalities of getting stuff out the door. And so the film in no way looks like you've done any compromises, but clearly there are places where you have to be sensible to deal with stuff, no matter how many licenses you have. So if it's right with you, I thought we'd explore a few of those. And I was going to start with the trash sequences, because you've been here at SIGGRAPH Asia discussing the film, and you were discussing how you came up with some interesting approaches to soft bodies.
Yes. So the typical approach for soft body simulation is you run an expensive simulation. It takes a lot of time, and you can't iterate on it. So one of the things that we tried on Toy Story 3 is to do rigid body simulations to give a soft body look. And the advantages of that was you could iterate. It was very fast, and it gave the artist a lot of opportunity to really push the look.
So that was using NED, is that right? Which was the simulation that was first came up with in Up for the balloons?
Yes, so NED is the framework, and you can run all these simulators offline that can be extremely fast. So we can pick a simulator that's appropriate for NED, and NED has got an interface to these other simulation engines. So we can pick actually the best, fastest, cheapest one for the job.
So is NED a shell around a physics engine? I mean, and it's basically just a rigid body sims engine with what?
Yeah, so NED is a frame around, and then we have a way to bring the data back into Maya so we can see it. And the advantage of NED is it's fast, so we're trying to not slow down Maya. We're running things interactively within Maya, but we want to see the data, and we use a file format called TID that we read the data back in.
And so the key of obviously a fast and good rigid body simulator is collision detection. Is the model basically fast and furious, like a kind of just a sort of bounding box kind of thing, or does it get quite accurate with actual shapes when they go to the narrow pass?
Yeah, so it's fast and furious. What we're trying to do is, for the trash sequence, it was background simulation, so we're able to do it very cheaply. It didn't have to be exact. We just had a lot of data that we had to get through and get a lot of visual detail through. So the whole thing about the approach that we took with the rigid body simulation is it's fast, it's cheap, it's not accurate. You can get as many iterations as possible through it.
So, of course, what seemed to be a great advantage is combining that with some really intelligent shaders. And I think the example that you were talking about before was in the explosion sequence of the bridge in the early part of the film, when we're mentioning a vast sequence with the toys. And you were showing some explosions and also some smoke sims type stuff. Now, normally that would be done with fluid sims, but you weren't doing it that way.
Yes, and the reason we didn't do it fluid simulations was it's hard to actually shade a fluid simulation. If you have a volumetric particle, you have a small particle that you can shade with a lot of detail, and so we thought that would be advantageous over a fluid simulation. The other advantage is because we're doing small particles, you can simulate them extremely quickly, where a fluid simulator, you know, is working with Navier-Stokes and all those difficult equations, and they take a long time, and you have to wait, and it just stops iteration, which is important.
Yeah, I mean, the Navier-Stokes approach, obviously the classic approach, is to either go with some kind of like particle system in the first place or not. But depending on which of the two approaches you take, you do get tremendously good results with a high degree of accuracy, which is great. Of course, the thing is that I guess at some point you have to step in and say, yes, I'm going to get really accurate fluid sims, but accuracy may not be the main reason someone goes to see Toy Story.
Exactly. We're after drama. So we did all this work and we showed all this stuff, and at the very end we cheated to camera. We really exaggerated what we did, and it was more important to create a dramatic effect than an accurate effect.
If I was doing a fluid sims, I would obviously polygonalize the particle cloud that I got out of it, and then I would take that in and apply shaders and stuff to it. The approach you were taking was to do a sort of a particle sim and then to use some really nice RenderMan shaders for taking those rather coarse bubble-type particles and giving them, what, internal illumination and stuff. Can you discuss that a bit more?
Yeah, so that idea is accurate. We're getting these particles, and we're going to do a volumetric shader, which is ray matching. And the thing we like about that is we can really control how the shading of those particles both change, because we're doing texture lookups, over time and over space. And we can integrate these particles together in kind of a more creative manner than what we would with our fluid simulation. The thing about the fluid simulation is it's really actually hard to direct it. You know, we want a big explosion here and tapering off in a certain way over there. That's actually a hard problem to tackle.
Pixar famously did the deep shadows stuff that produced such terrific results on volumetric. Does that play into those shaders, or are you actually completely avoiding the problem by doing it the way we're describing?
In this instance, we're going around that with the volumetric shading, but deep shaders are cool.
They're extremely cool.
Yeah.
There's some other things in the film that we just heard you discussing that were really intelligent kind of ways of achieving results. Can you discuss a couple of those?
Yeah, so there's a few tricks we have. In lighting, for example, typically, you know, of course we use RenderMan and we render up the whole scene, but there's a lot of things that we need to add at the end, like blooming, to just give that kind of extra punch. One of the really good examples that was talked about was being able to tune the saturation fairly interactively with a set of lights, just to give, you know, a very specific look. And in our process, we're trying to give the director a variety of looks, so we need like 10 different lighting scenarios so he can look at all of those. We need to create them quickly, and he can be able to choose between them which one he wants to go and guide us to kind of the next 10 iterations. So for us, we have to produce a lot, so we have to find fast ways to get to that point where we can shader director.
And there's some really interesting techniques used in the conveyor belt sequence with the trash as well, because that's also where you're using that trick of effectively doing soft bodies with rigid bodies. But now I was referring actually to the lighting.
So with the lighting on the conveyor belt, it's moving through all these lighting setups. And so we have to, we build a lighting setup to give a specific look, and then we transition between these lighting setups. And when you move fast enough between a sequence, it's actually quite dramatic. And it's a good example of how we're taking kind of shortcuts in both areas. So we've got the soft body look done as rigid body simulations, and we've got the lighting, these multiple setups with fast ways to light all in one sequence.
Yeah, I like that technique of actually rendering from the key light, basically, and then taking that and then projecting that onto square light so that you get back from the likes of the roof, for example, the actual sort of what would otherwise be a much more complicated radiosity solution. It would seem like a really great kind of trick around.
Yeah, we don't do much radiosity.
Because that was an incredibly geometrically heavy sequence. I mean, it was astonishingly detailed in terms of complexity.
Yeah, that was the sequence that almost broke us at the end of the movie, and it was kind of an exciting time. But fortunately, there was a lot of planning, and we were finding cheap ways to do it. So we give a lot of visual detail, and it's how can we give that visual detail cheaply enough to still convince us that there is a lot of detail there.
Yeah. So now you're, of course, an animation supervisor. Maybe you could talk about one of the characters that you animated. And let's start with Big Baby. You actually obviously supervised animators, but you actually got hands-on with that character.
Yeah, Big Baby was exciting to me because, one, he was like one of Lee's favorite characters. He was an actual doll that Lee had that we could reference to. But he was a combination of hard plastic and cloth fabric. And these were a type of materials that we hadn't done before, intermingling these into a single character. So I was kind of excited about, capturing those materials accurately. And I was also excited about the kind of limitations of the character, because he does move very stiffly, and it's actually trying to capture the dull aspects of this. It would be very easy to make him move too much, and then you'd lose the kind of dull baby doll aspect of them.
I have to say, one of my favourite bits was the head rotation on the swing. Did that come early, or was that like... because that just seemed inspired.
Yeah, that was Lee's vision. He definitely succeeded in making the baby scary, spooky. A lot of kids had it. And I love him as a villain because in some ways he's underplayed, but he is so menacing.
Yeah, I think the eye also helped, one of the eyes being different.
Yeah, the broken eye, and I think we all remember toys with that broken eye, so the actual doll had a broken eye. It was like, we have to capture that, and it was like, well, it's easy to do, but it just makes the character so much more menacing.
You said you had an actual doll. Was that a maquette, or was that actually just a plastic toy that was used for reference?
That was a plastic toy, one of Lee's favourite toys growing up, and actually had graffiti from him.
Really?
Yeah, back in the day.
Because you actually tried getting some Lotso China bears made in the early stages of the film, didn't you?
Yes. So for him, we knew that we were going to sell a Lotso at the end, so we decided to reverse the process and say, let's make Lotso at the start, and then we can use him as reference. But of course, it's a chicken and egg problem. You have to design him, and then you build him, and then you find the builders off, so you redesign him. So we were constant coordinate cycle. But we learned a lot of information just by getting... we built him four times, and we got a lot of information from going through that process.
Yeah, because some of the toys have become so iconic now that it's hard to remember that you couldn't actually buy them as toys. But by the same token, others, I mean, you know, certainly most people in my office have Buzz Lightyears and quite expensive ones, it seems as that.
Right.
How iterative is that process? Is it, I mean, you must actually sort of notice these real toys in between films.
Yeah, the funny thing is, you know, we got to rebuild Buzz and Woody, and we actually went down to our store and we bought a Buzz and we looked at him and looked at all the manufacturing imperfections and was like, we've got to capture some of this back in the model now we're rebuilding him, because you actually see what they do when they make them with all the imperfections.
Yeah, the toy soldiers in the original Toy Story 1, I remember having the plastic sort of seam line, and I remember that as a child and at the time thinking, wow, they've just really gone all out here. But in that remodeling of Woody and Buzz, you also adjusted some of the textures and sort of things like the stitching and stuff. Can you just quickly touch on those redesign points?
Yeah, we wanted to make them more toy-like, because the features of a toy is that the features are actually larger. And so when we looked at a lot of the original models, they'd been all built too small, the bevels were too sharp, and we just wanted to go to what we call toy tolerance, where we look at an actual bevel of a real plastic toy and we try to match that. Because we did want to make a more realistic world. Oh, it's funny you also mentioned the toy soldiers, because we wanted to get a toy soldier with a plastic seam in it, but the manufacturers improved to such a stage that they don't make that anymore, so it was actually impossible to buy a real one.
And also there was a move, from a technical point of view, moving some of the stuff from NURBS to subdivisions, right?
Oh, yeah.
So, like, that actually affected things like, what, Woody's ear?
Yeah, so you look back and it's because, you know, if you build from NURBS, things are a lot busier, you've got all these square patches you're putting together. And so we had an opportunity to go back and just clean all that up, make a subdivision mesh, which was much simpler and a little more accurate, I think.
And then you were also touching on, technically, how you were doing the cloth differently, if I remember.
Yeah, so our cloth has evolved at Studio, so we were able to create shaders using the same shading that we use for our cloth. So we call that polynomial texture maps, and we're able to apply like real cloth for the fabric of Jessie and the doll. So we think that gave a more realistic look for her.
It also seemed like perhaps some of the stitching had changed in scale as well, because, of course, that's one of the things that not just the weave, but even the sort of stiffness of the fabric on a scale issue. And then, of course, the threads tend to seem the same size no matter what, whether you're moving real clothing or children's toys. But, of course, the scale is wrong.
Right, exactly. So we had to reorientate our scales for toys. So stitching on a human, you know, the stitching is large, and we wanted to have that large stitching on a toy to emphasize the fact that they were toys. And also for readability, it's sometimes hard to see some of the things we modeled back in the day. So having large stitching just emphasizes the toy likeness.
And it seems from a character point of view that the biggest change, I mean, obviously the, some of those things like the holster and the sheriff's badge are kind of more like props, but you were actually working most, I guess, from the model on the mouths. Is that what I gathered?
Yeah, so back in the day when we built the mouths, we found that the position wasn't ideal for animation, and we saw some artifacts on them that you'd see throughout the movie. So we wanted to go back and remodel the mouths and then put all the new animation controls on them so they would animate better and they would look a little better and they were more neutral. So when I talk about neutral, I mean is remove all the expression from them. They had a little bit of expression still there that you'd fight against for the whole movie, and we could actually had an opportunity to take that out so it'd actually be exactly neutral.
And let's talk about Buzz for a second, because we had the mouth expression, which was slightly open before and was now closed in the neutral pose, but also he looked kind of startled, partly as a result of that. But then the character had to be incredibly dynamic in this, because the range of motion required for Spanish Buzz, I presume, was more than we'd seen in the previous film. So was there a re-rigging, and if so, what was the update there?
Yeah, so we totally re-rigged him. We did find in previous movies, because he had that sense of shock in the neutral position, it was really hard to get rid of it. We wanted a greater range of expression, so we neutralized it, and then we added in all these new controls, more modern controls, to give it like a greater range of expression. And then we had to, of course, create style and expression charts to make sure that we don't go off packet, because it's easy to push him too far and it's no longer Buzz, which is a kind of a trap.
But I mean, in Spanish Buzz, he virtually is a new Buzz, because there's a kind of an underlying personality and also a fluidity that there seemed to be more, well, for want of a better term, stretching, because his limbs needed to have more sort of dramatic poses. Obviously, in the first one, he did lots of jumping around with the laser, but apart from that, he wasn't a Spanish dancer like he is in this one.
Yeah, I thought Spanish Buzz was inspired. Carlos did an amazing job animating him, and I look back and I still laugh at it every time I see it. And it was, you know, pushing certain features in a certain way, and Carlos really just caught that. A lot of it is him looking in the mirror, dancing and posing, and he just kind of caught a little bit of himself in there.
Yeah, it's funny that, isn't it? Because there's such a heritage with those characters, and then obviously you had some of the new ones like Lotso that had no pre-existing heritage, though they had to all exist in the same kind of world. Was there anything that you really came up against that you couldn't tweak to get into kind of your modern pipeline? Was there any aspect of the older characters that were just really frustrated that somebody made a decision to do X and you were stuck with it?
Yeah, probably the most frustrating character actually was Ham, because you could slide his legs anywhere over his body and he had a fillet which would make them smooth. But if you slide his legs over the body, you can see the textures there. So we wanted to make the textures better, which means, of course, we can't slide his legs over, but that limits animation. So it was this really frustrating problem of what do we do about Ham's legs? And it's so silly, because you look at the character and he looks incredibly simple, but he's actually incredibly annoying.
Well, thanks so much for taking time to talk to us. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Well, thanks to Mike and Brian for bringing us that interview. So like I said, keep your eyes open for FX Guide right after the first of the year. Hopefully you'll see some exciting new changes and moving us forward, giving us lots of capabilities as we move into the new year. So that's it. That'll do it for this FX Podcast. For Mike and John, this is Jeff. We'll see you on the next FX Podcast.
Please let us know if you have any suggestions for stories or future podcasts. You can reach us by clicking the Contact Us link at the top of the homepage. This podcast is copyright FX Guide, LLC. Broadcast or redistribution is prohibited without the expressed written consent of FX Guide.